Welcome Central Wisconsin Christian School students. Would they please stand?
Big girl.
Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here today with a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program is cleverly entitled Court with Class, and students around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument, and they're given materials about the case. They may do some extra assignments relating to the case. They come here, listen to an oral argument, and a justice is assigned for the day to speak with the students at lunchtime. And so we welcome them. The discussion at lunchtime will be about the procedures of the court in taking a case and deciding a case. Discussion at lunchtime with the justice will not be about the substantive issues involved in the case. So if anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Hearing none, I will introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice assigned today to meet with the students. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Losh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crux. And I will say that since today is Veterans Day, he is the only veteran on the court. So thank you, Justice Crux. Seated next to Justice Crooks is Justice Patience Robensack, and on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, 11AP387D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Michael M. Is it Rajek? And the first speaker will be Attorney Michael M. Rajek, representing himself. Mr. Rajek, you have 25 minutes. Mr. Arnold, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation, will have 30 minutes, and then you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Rajek. You may proceed.
Good morning. I'm addressing the court today. I have responded to the formal complaint from the Office of Lawyer Regulation charging that I didn't adequately provide an accounting and fee resolution dispute to several clients that I represented in past years. We have, as the court's well aware, submitted written briefs, which will pretty much frame the issues, and I'm not going to repeat myself too much about that. There is a couple of comments that I want to make, and I'm going to be as brief as I can. The referee in this particular case indicated that that I did have a detailed multi-page fee agreement, which covers three of the six important things that you're supposed to advise people of if they complain about their bill. And the referee in this case did indicate that these alleged violations are highly technical, and I think that's important to impress upon this court that they are, in fact, highly technical. And another thing that's important to note is that each of these clients were, according to the record, well represented. They got, I feel, outstanding representation in each instance. There is one important thing that I'd like to point out and that I take strong dispute with, and that is that the retained counsel for OLR to my left indicated in his brief that there is an aggravating factor about my attitude and the fact that I vehemently denied any misconduct or violation of the rules, however technical, and that I had displayed an attitude throughout these proceedings that I was being singled out and persecuted by OLR. I just want to make a comment on that. I think that to make statements like that, when in fact a clear reading of the transcript would indicate that there is nothing, not one single thing in this transcript of this proceedings that would indicate that I didn't take these matters seriously, that I didn't, that I flaunted Supreme Court rules, or that I basically laughed in the face of authority. I couldn't disagree more respectfully with retained counsel in that regard. This has already been a long, drawn-out affair, and there isn't a single thing in the transcript of these proceedings that would indicate that that those statements made by retained counsel are true. And I want to strongly emphasize that to this court.
Mr. Rancic, do you dispute any of the facts that the referee found?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, what are they? And you know the test is that we're going to support
especially
counsel.
Pardon?
The test is that the referee found facts and they're supported by the record and they're not clearly erroneous. We're going to accept that. That's the standard of review.
There are some things I do specifically object to, and one is this Forrester matter.
Okay.
It was clear in the record of this case, Madam Chief Justice, that Mr. Forrester was fully and well advised of the fact that I would be appearing for him in court, that I would be resolving his case. And there was testimony taken from
was Mr. Forrester the person who you reduced it from a crime to a forfeiture?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And he claims that when I went to court for him, he's a day trader in the stock market, and court is at 9:30 or 11 o'clock in our county, and he couldn't be there most days because that's his busy time. But be that as it may, I had his, when he came to my office after this case was set for when I entered a plea for him to a traffic citation rather than a criminal offense, I had my legal assistant at the time listen in, and he specifically made statements regarding the fact that he knew that I had authority to act for him and things along those lines. And the referee did find that I had not properly communicated with my client, which is completely false. It's not what happened. And he found some technical violation of a Supreme Court rule based on that. And I strongly object to that. It was proven, I think, at the hearing in that case, in front of the referee, that this guy couldn't tell the truth.
Well, the referee expressed some doubts.
What?
Referee expressed some doubts about credibility.
Well, he did. And he specifically said that his story wasn't credible. And I think that holds true to everything that he said in this case. And I don't see how this referee can make a finding like he found in that case under these circumstances. And I feel that alleged breach of Supreme Court rules should be discharged. And the second, another thing I just want to briefly mention is that on every one of these cases, as I indicated, the clients got good representation. They got their case resolved favorably for them, and these were allegedly disputes regarding accounting of fees and dispute resolutions. Now, especially in this case involving this gentleman named Mr. Coggins, attached to my reply brief is a copy of a letter that was an exhibit in this matter, in which he's begging me to send him back some money in this case because he needed to pay his hospital bill or something along those lines. It was not a request for an accounting, and it was not a request to say that I'm disputing your bill. In fact, he didn't even pay, 60% of his bill.
Was that the repossession of the car, or is that something else?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I don't want to lose my car. Give me my money back, some of my money back. And OLR says, hey, well, this is a fee dispute, and you didn't do this and do this and do this. I have a fee agreement in place, and it's clear from the record in this case. I felt and did feel at the time that fee agreement covered everything I needed to have covered.
Why did you think that?
Well, it's like 12 pages long. It covers arbitration.
Well, that's a start.
It covers about everything under the sun. And I went to a national seminar. And it's where I got that fee agreement from, where we talked. It was an ethics thing about fees and to try to avoid disputes. That's why it's such a long technical thing. But it doesn't have some of the magic words that the Supreme Court rule and OLR wants us to have in there. Now I've changed it. I got somebody at the state bar to help me out. The OLR office didn't want to get it correct.
One of the problems about the automobile is that the rules require that you give an accounting at the end, right?
Right.
And advise the client of how much time has been spent, etc. And another part of the rules is if there is a dispute about the fees mm-hmm. that you charge, that there's a provision in the agreement about arbitration, or is a mediation of mm-hmm. arbitration of the fees. And that was missing from your long form, right?
I agree with that.
And in several of these, repeatedly, the issue was you didn't provide an accounting at the termination of the representation and didn't tell the client about the possibility of arbitration. And the result is, on all of that, that, well, maybe in this case you think it's a gift, but there's a theme in these cases that you're not returning funds that weren't used for the client. You're not giving them an accounting, and you're not telling them they have a dispute with you. There are ways of settling it. I mean, that's the theme. Am I wrong? I mean, that's the theme I got from the referee. That's even the theme I got from you.
I'm having trouble hearing you, ma'am.
Pardon me? I said that's the theme I got from the referee. Am I wrong?
Not completely, but not completely right either.
Okay. Half is good.
You're aware that my almost 100% of my practice is criminal defense.
Yes, I understand that.
Criminal defense, and I've been doing this almost four decades. And in criminal defense, when you're a sole practicing attorney like I am, it's very important that you receive fees, because otherwise you have to close your door and you can't pay your employees.
I understand. And when the court had this rule before it, it had a different rule before this rule, and the criminal bar and the family law bar objected strenuously on the very grounds you were stating.
Right.
And then we put this rule into effect.
Right. Well, some of the same problems are still existing in the real practice of law out there, and this rule doesn't make it any easier for us to survive.
So when you do flat fee, do you believe that flat fee is earned?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you why.
In other words, let me be, you understand, but let me make sure everyone else understands. And that is when they pay a flat fee of, let's say, $5,000, that's what it's going to cost them regardless of the outcome? Or
generally, yes. If you don't do it that way, I'm telling you, ma'am, Madam Justice, you'll be out of business, and the clients won't get. I won't have enough money to do pro bono work that I do. I won't have enough money to help out single immigrant women that get driving violations that have no money to pay me. I won't be able to do that.
When you let's say take a case for $5,000 flat fee. Do you keep, like some lawyers do, or maybe all lawyers do, except you, I don't know, hourly accounting of what you do?
Generally, ma'am, I don't like hourly accounting, and I'll tell you why. It's because there's a saying amongst attorneys, and I've been doing this 40 years almost, that according to their time slips, some attorneys are 190 years old. I don't necessarily think that just because somebody keeps time that it's number one accurate and number two reflects the value of the services.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think when you get a flat fee, $5,000 on some kind of a lower felony, misdemeanor, whatever it is, why do you think that's your money, that it's
earned when it's paid? It's kind of like today's Veterans Day, right? And this morning I was talking to a retired gunnery sergeant from the United States Marine Corps. A gunnery sergeant has red stripes on his right sleeve that go all the way up to here. He earned them. He got those stripes because he was competent. He got those stripes because he was a tough guy. And he got those stripes because he served. Same thing with veteran criminal defense attorneys. You earned it.
Well, another way to put it, Mr. Ajak, might be that when a client comes to see you to represent him or her, they don't really care how long it takes you. They just want a positive outcome.
That's correct.
And some of your work, when you take a flat fee case, and as I understand the record, you divide it up into stages of the proceedings. So, in other words, if it goes this far, it'll cost this much. If it goes that far, it'll cost an additional. So they know that from the upfront, and whether it's resolved by a plea, which would be a relatively minimal time for you, versus preparing for a jury trial and going through a jury trial, they don't care as long as they get the result they want. And a lot of cases, I suppose, one of the reasons you might do a flat fee, it reminds me of how a lot of people invest in the stock market. Dollar cost averaging. You do it over a long period of time at a consistent basis. Sometimes you're going to pay higher for the stock. Sometimes you're going to pay lower. But in the end, most people think over time it turns out to be a net gain. So you're kind of doing it the opposite way by charging the same flat fee. Some are going to take a lot of your time and consume a lot of your energy and a lot of your efforts, and some are going to consist of a few meetings with the DA to work out a plea agreement.
Just an example, the Coggins case. He had a prior felony for manufacturing and distribution of marijuana.
Can you speak up, please, to counsel?
He had a prior offense and a prior conviction before he came to see me for manufacturing and delivery of controlled substance marijuana. This particular case I represented him on, he had a grow project in his house, 400 plants. And I got him an arrangement in which he cooperated with the authorities. I think he had to do like 30 days, and on Huber law, and he didn't, and because I didn't get paid up front, I didn't get paid on that case. And then he turns around and wants $3,200 bucks back, so he doesn't lose his car to the bank. I don't know, but.
What do you think should be the response of this court? What should our opinion indicate?
Well, I think just like I said in my brief, from the outset here, I think this whole thing should have been handled differently by OLR. When I went up to pick up my niece's son from school the other day, there's this big sign that says "Stop Bullying." And that's what OLR does in a lot of cases, and I'm not kidding. They bully.
How were you bullied?
What?
How were you bullied?
How was I bullied? I've got a letter from their general counsel saying, well before the formal complaint was filed, saying you better take this, words to the effect that you better take what we're recommending here or this isn't going to go away. There was never an attempt to try to resolve this case, never an attempt to see somebody that's practiced law and helped people out for 40 years say, you know what, maybe you should just change your fee agreement, this, and you're doing this wrong, fix it. But no, they got to fire the howitzers. And I didn't appreciate that, and I don't appreciate it now. But at no time, and I want to make sure that everyone on the court listens to this and hears this, that at no time did I at any time express some type of a wrong type of an attitude throughout these proceedings that felt that
did,
I was...
Did the referee discuss your attitude? I mean, that's
no.
How... Okay.
No. And we were involved in a hearing that lasted only a few hours, and I don't know where he comes up with this.
I remember it, the referee, and I could be wrong, the referee had mitigating and
aggravating factors.
And aggravating factors, right?
Right.
And I thought that's where that came up.
The as I recall, the aggravating factors were he pointed to your attitude, but he also talked about two prior reprimands.
Yeah.
Then the mitigating factors was during this time span you had two strokes, as I recall, he had as mitigating.
Well,
factors.
One of the during the period of time that I supposedly didn't respond to Mr. Miller's attorney, I wasn't even there.
Now, that was at about a year, from March to then the spring of the following year.
Yeah, I almost didn't make it, so, but I'm here.
You survived to be here today.
I did.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Still trying to be feisty.
Counsel, Justice Bradley asked you how you would like this court to resolve your case, and I'm not sure I understood the answer.
Well,
are you looking for...
I'm not as familiar with the Supreme Court rules as I probably ought to be, but I think there's, in the several years, almost 10 years that I was a prosecutor, we used to do a lot of deferred prosecution agreements for people that unwittingly may have messed up, and that's what I think I'd like the court to find in this case. I wasn't out to... to flaunt these rules. I wasn't out to tell my clients to go jump in the river when they asked for their money back. I wasn't out to do that. I felt that under the circumstances at that time, I had a written fee agreement in place that was adequate. Apparently, it doesn't contain some of the. I think that some type of a compliance agreement, whatever. In the year 2013, a public reprimand goes on the internet. Will be on there forever, long after I'm gone. And I think it's almost like the scarlet letter, and I just don't think it's warranted when I never intended ever to do anything.
Counsel, as I read your brief, the answer to Justices Bradley and Prosser's question to you is you don't want a public reprimand.
No.
You want this court to say, okay, even if there were violations of the code, as the referee found, because the facts are not clearly erroneous, and they follow from the facts that you violated the code, even if you violated the code, that what should be done is not a discipline, and the court has that power under the rules, but that you should be required to take additional courses in ethics, if I remember your point, and that you would do two or three other things, if I can, I'll find it in your brief. And that's what you want. Isn't that right? You don't want the public reprimand. You're willing to
yes, I am.
Do various conditions, and you have set forth what your conditions should be.
Correct.
This is on page 10 of your brief. Additional professional responsibilities, CLA, within the next year. You have to take some anyway, I gather, under our rules. A requirement that you provide OLR with an updated copy of your written fee agreement, which is totally in compliance with the rules. That's number two. Number three, a requirement that you attest to the fact that you're going to only use only this correct form, right?
Yes.
And a requirement that you attest to the fact you will provide all clients with an accounting on termination of representation, whether they request it or not.
Correct.
In other words, you want the court to say, other than the additional CLE credit for professional responsibility, you want the court to say you are to follow the rules.
Yes.
Counsel, have any of the clients who are involved in this cumulative complaint, besides Mr. Forster, and we'll get to him in a second, have any of them alleged deficient performance on your part?
No.
They said
and
Forster, it turns out that he got exactly what you and he talked about at the initial meeting, which was a non-criminal disposition to a hit and run,
right,
with a hit and run of an occupied vehicle.
Hit and run of an occupied vehicle is a criminal offense. It was amended to a non-criminal offense.
I understand that.
Okay.
So, in other words, the only one who alleged deficient performance on your part turned out to have an incorrect understanding about some sort of default judgment.
Well, not only that, but he had other issues as well as his truth.
Well, and the referee referred to credibility issues with Mr. Forrester.
Right.
All right.
Mr. H, are there any other questions? If not, your time for your argument has expired. You get 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Arnold, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Good morning.
Morning, Chief Justice and Justices. My name is Wayne Arnold. I'm from Rice Lake. I am retained counsel in this case on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. You know, these matters are never pleasant for a variety of obvious reasons. I was going to just be brief and say we commend the comprehensive referee report to you. And we, the OLR, concurs in it, and we respectfully suggest that you adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, recommendations, and the recommended sanction, which is a public reprimand. I am going to respond to just a few points that were raised by Mr. Rajak, and he made much mention of the fact that the clients received a good result in the courtroom. Now, of course, there's more to the practice of law than just what goes on in the courtroom, and this is a very good example of relationship problems which are addressed by the rules in terms of advanced fee and what is required, and also responding to client requests for explanations of where the advanced fee went and so on and so forth. And so there's more to the relationship, more to the professional relationship than just what goes on in the courtroom.
Counselor, for those clients who had a flat fee agreement, what kind of an accounting should he have provided?
Well, that also gets to another point I intended to raise. And before I answer that, I'm going to say there's more to the issue than just the rule, the advanced fee protection alternative of 1.1. I'll leave out the 20 because they all have 20 in front of them, but the 1.15 paren B paren 4M. There's more to it than that because his own contract, which is common to all three affected clients, contemplates an hourly rate on page 2. It's a little unclear as to what the paragraph means at the top of page 2. It says something about if we part company midway, then we're going to calculate my fee on the basis of $200 an hour. And, of course, that presupposes then that he's keeping track of his time on an hourly basis, because otherwise how could you ever calculate that or respond to his own contractual language? So his own contracts in three of the cases contemplate an hourly rate and an accounting should they part company midway. So in addition to the 1.15 paren B paren 4M list of obligations, there's his own contract.
My question remains, for those clients for which a flat fee agreement was entered into, what kind of an accounting should he have provided?
Some sort of hourly, here's what happened.
So you believe that even with a flat fee agreement, he has an obligation to account on an hourly basis for all that he did during the representation?
Yes, based on the supplementation of his contract to the rule.
Okay, I'm perhaps not doing a good job of asking my questions. I want to look at the Supreme Court rule. I want you to tell me, with the rule that he's violated, what he should have provided for those clients with whom he had a flat fee agreement.
Well, the court fashioned a rule that said provide an accounting. That's the court's rule. I assume that if it's not hourly, if it doesn't involve time somehow, then you're left with the activities in the case.
All right. So if they know they got a criminal charge reduced to a traffic ticket, and it's a flat fee agreement, which means it doesn't matter if he doesn't get paid very much because he has to spend 10 times more time than he anticipated, or if he spent less time than he anticipated with the fee, that should be sufficient then, right?
Well, the rule requires an accounting. I assume it's either hourly or by activity. If hypothetically what you're suggesting is that a person simply say the fee was earned no matter how much activity went on, and that's the end of it, doesn't seem to me that's complying with the rule.
Well, you know, on the civil side of it, we have lawyers that do things on a contingency fee basis all the time. And once the case is concluded and they request their a third or a quarter or whatever they've agreed upon, do you think we expect those lawyers to also have said every single thing they did through maybe 2 years of representation?
Well, but there their fee usually comes after a successful conclusion to the case. Here we're talking about advanced fees.
Right.
And I assume the rationale the court was thinking about when it fashioned this alternative rule was, instead of G, which is advanced fees going to trust, and then as one works on the case and wants to make a draw, there's advance notice for the client.
That's a different thing than a flat fee. That's a retainer, right? You get a retainer from someone, and you can only put it into your regular account when you've earned it and you've gotten permission to take a draw. I just want to look at flat fee. And maybe it's your position that the flat fee is just, he just can't do this. He can't take a flat fee up front.
I don't want to get lost in definitional arguments. It's always been my understanding that technically a retainer is something that a lawyer is paid to remain on standby for major clients sometimes who have a litigious past. Very large companies and so on. And that is, in fact, probably earned because of the nature. It doesn't contemplate really much work, if any. It's a standby sort of situation. But this rule is talking about an alternative to the into trust and disperse out as one works through the case sequentially. And, you know, however that might be done. And I think I agree with you in the main that you've got to break the activities down into some sort of component parts. Commonly, that's done on a time basis. And, in fact, his own contract talks about time.
Well, it talks about time if they part company midway through representation, doesn't it?
Well, and that, the paragraph's a little confusing to me. I don't know whether it means it's going to apply in all cases or just to where they part company. It's preceded by a sentence that talks about parting company mid-case.
Counsel, I think that there's room for argument that our rules are confusing. Do you think that in a flat fee arrangement, the provisions of the advanced fee alternative indicate that an advanced fee is always subject to being refunded, and that a lawyer must always determine how much of an advanced fee has been earned so that a refund can be made, if necessary, upon termination of the representation. Do you think our rules provide for what I just read from a memo I have, that the flat fee comes within the advanced fee alternative, and that our rules indicate that an advanced fee, that is a flat fee, is always subject to being refunded, and that a lawyer must always determine how much of an advanced fee has been earned so that a refund can be made if necessary upon termination. Is that what our rules provide?
Yes, and I think the rule, of course, as all rules do, you're trying to encompass the limitless variations in attorney-client interactions. In other words, let's say, for whatever reason, the client discharges a lawyer very quickly after receiving a substantial advance fee. There has to be, you know, some kind of accounting. Now, you know, it's possible, depending on the circumstances, that the fee was earned in a short period of time. But on the other hand, it's possible that it was not.
Yeah, it is complex, and when it is earned is difficult, is part of the confusion. I look at Supreme Court Rule 20, the definition, 20.1.0DM, which defines flat fee. Do you have that in front of you, or?
Sorry, I should have been looking for it.
That's okay.
You want to give that cite to me again?
Yeah.
The definition.
It's 20.1.0, terminology.
The definition section.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it defines in DM flat fee. And this is my problem with our rules, because I think there is room to interpret our rules as there's no such thing as a flat fee, or what we've been talking about on the bench as a flat fee. You pay your money and you get the result. You know, you pay your $5,000 and that's it. That kind of approach seems to be you pay your $5,000 and that's it, commensurate with the definition of flat fee. The definition of flat fee includes, in the final sentence, flat fee becomes the property of the lawyer upon receipt. Boy, I would think that means it's mine. But you're saying our rules provide otherwise. The flat fee definition in the first sentence of that definition. Flat fee denotes a fixed amount paid to a lawyer for specific agreed-upon services or a fixed agreed-upon stage in a representation, regardless, it only says it once, I put it in there three times, of the time required of the lawyer to perform the service or reach the agreed-upon stage in the representation. I would think that those two sentences, it's my property upon receipt, I would interpret that to mean it's my money. I would interpret regardless of the time required of the lawyer to perform may mean, since it's regardless, that the hourly billing might not be important. But you're telling me other places in the rule that there's no such thing as a flat fee. It's always subject to further negotiations.
Well, the rule certainly contemplates that, the B4M. And then when you read, you know, really if you take that argument to its extension, then G really doesn't apply either. Why put money in trust? Ever.
So this
Why not just stick it right into the business account?
Well, that's what our change in our advance fee allowed for,
right.
Sticking it in your business account. That's why I wrote a concurrence.
Right.
And I said, and you know what I said in that concurrence. It didn't make sense to me.
So a lot of this turns as to where the lawyer put the money, in the business account or in the trust account.
I didn't catch the first part.
I said some of this depends on where the lawyer put the money, in the trust account or in the business account. If he puts it in the trust account, he's got to take it out as earned and meet the requirements. If he puts it in his business account, he's got to account for it.
I've always read the alternative advanced fee, BM, to be the flip side of G. In other words, G goes into the trust account. You can parcel it out upon some advance notice to the client and with a billing explanation. And give them a chance to object and that sort of thing. But here, B4M allows you to put it in the general account, but you have to account for it after the fact. And, of course, from the perspective of the client, if you will, the B4M is a little more, you know, it's already in the general account. You know, there's a mechanism, you know, to resolve disputes. But there's greater client protection under G, you know, the old rule, if you will, or the rule of some longstanding vintage about what to do about advanced fees. And that's what G is all about. They're not talking about billing at the conclusion of a case and getting paid. Obviously, that just goes into the case is over and you've earned the fee.
The worst thing, counsel, that your opposing counsel did?
I think that which is missing in the contract, the referee termed those technical deficiencies. I don't disagree. Our brief agreed with that. But it's that in conjunction with no response to the clients when they have questions. They're not lawyers. You know, they're not sophisticated. They may never have had contact with a lawyer previously. And so when they call wanting to know about, you know, is there anything left, especially the Miller case where the gentleman died mid-case and his brother is calling from Virginia, I see this $8,500 check you wrote. What's that all about? You know, do we owe you anything? Where I'm closing up his estate. As found by the referee, it took over a year for any kind of explanation to get to the brother. He even had to he had already hired the lawyer in Medford to help resolve the case, the estate, I should say. And the lawyer wrote two letters asking for an explanation and never got a response. I mean, there's got to be some sort of mechanism in place to provide that.
Well,
as the referee suggests.
Didn't opposing counsel have a stroke during that time?
He did. During some of that time, he was ill.
What's the obligation of a lawyer if you're out of the office for that length of time and have pending matters?
Well, one would like to think that the office can function, at least to that extent, in your absence. There are limitless variations, I'm sure.
In response, did the clients get a respond that he's out of the office and ill, and it will be taken care of when he comes back?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't think that fact was developed.
Does the state bar or some other entity have a model fee agreement that completely complies with the court's rules?
I know the state bar, especially when this rule came about, had a number of seminars, and they have something on their website under their aids to lawyers in practice, and it's still up on the website as to what you need to do. To me, it's easy enough. You just cut and paste the rule, put it in the if you intend on putting your advance fees into the general account. You know, if you're going to operate under the advance fee alternative, then I think your contract is simply copy and paste the rule and then make sure nothing else in the contract is, you know, contrary to any of those provisions. But it's not that hard, I don't think. It's not that hard to do.
I interpret your answer to say that there is not a pre-existing model form from the state bar. Is that right?
I know Tim Pierce has something up on his website, and it's been a while since I looked at it, and he may very well have that. I can tell you OLR does not generate a particular fee agreement which they've passed muster on. I mean, they don't want to get into the business of pre-approving a limitless variation.
Just like they don't pre-approve advertisements.
Same reason, I'm sure.
Well, there's a substantial cost here that is the OLR has filed. There's been no objection to it. But what it leads me to think, and from what I read in the briefs, Mr. Rajek objected, denied doing anything wrong, right?
Yes. If you read the referee report, I think it's in the near the back. Mr. Rajek's answer to the amended complaint was he denied having these people as clients, denied his own name.
Denied the existence or authority of OLR.
Well, and in addition to that, the way the case proceeded, there was a summary judgment motion on Barwick, which really is in common with two other cases. The referee granted OLR summary judgment in those matters, and there was no interest in acknowledging the obvious on the other two, which had identical contracts. So we were put to our proof on that. You know, certainly lawyers have every right to contest these matters and make use of the procedures that are available to them. They're encouraged to do that, but the fact of the matter is their litigation posture is a major factor in what drives the cost. In fact, I think Mr. Rajek availed himself of a cost-free stipulation on his public reprimand. So he's well aware of how that can work.
Now, Mr. Rajic was represented by counsel before the referee.
Through the hearing, right.
Through the hearing. Did they ask for diversion?
I think that they asked for essentially what they just asked, or what Mr. Rajic asked now, and the referee deals with that in his sanction recommendation. He said essentially he reads Mr. Rajic and his attorney that their request for ultimate resolution, which was, I guess, a couple of questions driving at that issue, what amounted to a diversion. There is a diversion process that normally is handled by the director, but a lawyer is not subject to diversion if they've had public discipline within 5 years previously. And the trouble is Mr. Rajic did have that, so it was not available.
So he wasn't subject to the diversion that we have in the statute.
Correct.
So OLR had to do it this way. If it was going to...
Right, but under 2209, a lawyer can stipulate to a public or a private reprimand, and costs are waived. And that is always made known. It's just general procedure. It's always made known to a lawyer in that sort of circumstance, and, you know, without getting into matters that are, you know, aren't part of the record, I mean, that was obviously done here, and of course then there was the prior experience of just that, of availing himself of that.
Is it accurate to say, counsel, that the OLR did file a statement on restitution, and in that statement it said it was not seeking restitution because there was no known monetary losses that had resulted from the alleged misconduct?
Correct.
And the OLR stated that the district committee had, quote, concluded Attorney Rajic performed substantial work for all three clients, and there was no concern that the fees were unearned. That's accurate, too.
I think that was part of the district committee finding, yes.
So I guess my question is, Mr. Rajic raised this in his original argument, and you referred in response to Justice Prosser's question, you said that the referee had called it a technical matter. I think the phrase used was a highly technical offense. And with all of these things, substantial work having been performed, no concern about unearned fees, no one's out any money, it seems to me that he got pretty good outcomes for his clients, especially Mr. Forrester's case stands out in particular. Having had the privilege of serving as a prosecutor and a trial court judge, on the face of it, it seems like a remarkable outcome. Why not, why not take his advice and someone from the OLR come to see him and say, you know, we understand all these factors. It's a highly technical offense. You've done substantial work. You've worked for and received positive outcomes for your clients. Why not change your fee agreement to our standard form so these kinds of misunderstandings don't happen in the future?
I don't think it's strictly the fee agreement. It's the behavior towards the clients at the conclusion of the case. I mean, all four of them, well, one died, but all four entities were so upset they ended up finding their way down to OLR. I mean, that is easily handled.
Yeah, but you're including Mr. Coggins in that, who's basically asking for $3,200 because he can't. He starts his letter, Mr. Coggins starts his letter to Mr. Rajic saying, thank you, and I think he repeats, thank you, for all of your good work. But could I please have $3,200 back because otherwise I can't have a car? So I don't see how you can lump that in with a client who's been wrong.
Let's talk about Mr. Coggins for just, it's getting close to the end. We did not If you look at B4M, there's 10 possible ways to violate that rule. There's 8 affirmative notices, and then there's an accounting affirmative obligation, and then there's a contingent obligation where you send it to arbitration if there's a dispute. The charge in Mr. Coggins was not fractionated into each of those, actually 7 potential violations, because we acknowledge right off the bat that his agreement did cover the first 3. So even if you say, okay, that wasn't a legitimate enough dispute to trigger C, the very last one in the B4M list of 7, there remains the other 6. Even if you want to discount, or if for the sake of argument want to say Mr. Coggins' comment or request did not rise to the level of a genuine dispute, there remain the other 6 violations of the B4M rule.
Well, did any of those occur while he was getting rehabilitation or treatment for his stroke? Or 2 strokes, I guess.
I don't think the timing matched up there on Mr. Coggins.
What else do you want to say in summation, counsel?
I think I covered the points I wanted to make. I know you have a busy calendar. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Rajek?
Madam Chief Justice, I would want to just briefly point out one other thing in my final comments to the court, and that would be that the retained counsel has again brought up the issue of attitude, and I want to point out that the civil answers to complaints and things like that, and putting OLR to their proof, were done by my lawyer, not by me. I really didn't even know or had no idea what he answered, why he did it, or whatever. But I find that blaming me for the civil steps that the counsel took in representing me, I think is incredulous. And I'd ask that you take that into account. Again, indicating that this is I think, unreasonable and on their part. And that's all I'm going to say. I've made my argument, and I respectfully thank all of you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. As Mr. Arnold stated, these cases are always very difficult. As Mr. Arnold stated, these cases are always very difficult for the court, and we appreciate your coming and stating your case and responding to the court's question. The court had worked hard and had a number of hearings relating to advance fees, earned fees, depositing them in the business account versus depositing in the trust account. And many people worked very hard to get a rule that met the needs of the practice and the needs of the clients. And as Justice Bradley pointed out, the rule may still have some issues. That ends our case in 11AP387D. Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Michael M. Rajek. The court will take a brief recess so the students may leave the courtroom, and we will reconvene in a few moments to hear our second case today. We are in recess.